sometimes struggle to get up in the morning or wind down for bed at night. I used to find it so difficult. I woke up with no sense of positivity and brightness. I was void of motivation and spirit. This changed completely when I started waking up with a Lumi body clock. These incredible devices mimic the light and colour of a real sunrise and sunset, transforming the experience of waking up and going to sleep completely. Rather than being suddenly woken up with an alarm clock, the Lumi body clock will wake you up gradually with a natural sunrise. The Lumi body clock has been shown to improve the quality of sleep and awakening, and to boost mood and productivity in clinical trials. You can personalise your sunrise and sunset from 15 to 90 minutes with their clinically tested unique natural light and more than 20 sleep and wake sounds. We all deserve to sleep well and to wake up feeling fresh. So if you're finding this a challenge and you want to try a new approach, go to Lumi.com.
I would say pretty profound. I mean, music's been a part of my life really since I was a little kid. My parents were super into music and my father is a phenomenal musician. He never played professionally or anything like that. I mean, small bands here and there when I was younger, but yeah, music's a big part of my background for sure. A lot of big musical influences that I've had over the years as well.
And in terms of like artists who you really enjoy or grew up on, bands, you know, what would be the earliest musical memory that you've got of, you know, thinking this is incredible?
Yeah. I mean, very early on in childhood, you know, my parents were super into the Doors, the Beatles, the Eagles, CCR, Jimi Hendrix, Stevie Ray Vaughan. I mean, the list goes on and on from like that era of music, I would say. And then as I got older, of course, my own tastes evolved, but I still listen to pretty much everything. I'd say the only thing that I don't listen to is country music, but I have nothing against country music. It's just never sort of been anything that myself or my friends have listened to a whole lot of. Certainly can appreciate the art for what it is. But yeah, my music is pretty diverse with everything that I'll listen to.
And do you still find yourself revisiting the classics that you grew up on? I mean, that's a pretty big bucket list of like the best rock music that there is.
Yeah, no, constantly. I'm constantly going to like Vietnam War era playlists in Spotify to see and learn like new stuff that was out in like that generation, I guess. Like the Vietnam War era music for some reason always just has spoken to me in an interesting way. So that's been a huge portion of my life, I'd say.
And in terms of today, do you stream on Spotify and do you listen to new artists, like, or is it are you entrenched in the past?
Yeah, no, I love the way that Spotify will suggest other artists to listen to, whether you're listening to older music or today's current music. They will recommend, you know, you might like this, you might like that. So yeah, and I'm pretty open to anything that the internet may think that I would be interested in. And occasionally I do find some pretty cool bands that I get introduced to, especially I find when it comes to listening to movie scores. I listen to a lot of movie scores, especially when I'm writing. So a lot of times once the score runs out, like the playlist runs out that the score is a part of, it will just start recommending other artists, and whether those are artists that are composers in the realm of feature films or television shows, or just artists that may be similar sounding. I found quite a few bands just from that sort of tie-in.
And when you, because you maintain what seems like a very hectic schedule, do you get to listen to music every day, and do you listen to music much whilst you're working?
I definitely listen to music every day. I listen to music when I'm in the shower in the morning. I listen to music when I'm in the shower at night. I listen to music on the way to work, music on the way home from work, music at the gym, music on airplanes when I'm traveling. I listen to music when I'm working, if I'm writing, but I only listen to scores when I'm writing. I can't listen to music that's got lyrics in it. It like grabs my brain and sends it in different directions. So I would say that I listen to music without question every single day, and it makes up at least a portion of everything that I'm doing throughout the course of the day, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I'm sure many of our listeners maintain similar habits, but it's extraordinary because often we'll get big name musicians on this podcast, and they'll tell me that they don't listen to music at all, and they just play gigs. And I mean, depending on what the sound is like for them in their monitors, that is a very, very different experience to just being able to sit back and really just soak in the brilliance of music as a right. fan. When did your journey as this, you know, incredible wildlife educator, YouTuber, writer, I mean, you name it, you've had so many successes. When did this whole journey start for you? Because I'm guessing in your childhood, much like my own, you know, being a YouTuber for one didn't exist at all. So how did this all begin? Because it's a fascinating story.
Yeah. You know, I, like many kids, grew up loving animals, loving dinosaurs. One always leads to the other, and then your imagination just runs wild. I spent a lot of time in libraries as a kid reading books, you know, where a younger generation now may absorb content through their smart device. My smart device back in the day, I'm sure like yours and many others in our age bracket, absorb their knowledge from libraries and books. Before the internet came around. So I was hugely inspired by a lot that I was reading. And then I grew up in a very rural area of Ohio. So Ohio here in the United States, where I had just countless acres behind my parents' property growing up, where I would go and adventure and explore and get up close with everything that I possibly could. And when it was the right animal species to be able to interact with or catch, I was certainly practicing that craft as well. So animals had a big influence on me very early on. And then when I got through high school and got into college, I really got into the art of storytelling. So my actual degree from the Ohio State University is in screenwriting, producing, and directing. So I was very much into how do you take a story, craft it into something that is understandable for an audience, and then deliver them that level of entertainment. And when I got out of college, I kind of went down some roads that were maybe going to turn into, you know, producing and directing independent films. It's a very difficult road to navigate. And at the right place at the right time, a couple of things aligned for us to start developing an outdoor animal adventure series. It just really wasn't happening the way that it had been happening through my childhood with people like, you know, there was something called Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. You had Steve Irwin, you had Jeff Corwin, you had Marty Stauffer, Jack Hanna, you know, this whole collection of interesting people that inspired me. But when Steve Irwin passed away in 2006, it really left quite the void in the animal adventure space, also mixed with entertainment. And we sort of saw that opening and went for it. And I took all my skills as a storyteller and director from behind the camera, then got in front of the camera and assembled a team that essentially has been following me ever since to capture all of these wild escapades on camera. And then YouTube obviously became our distribution platform to the world. And while we have done a series for Animal Planet, and I've done a number of other like movie studio branded deals and stuff like that, the distribution space of YouTube is definitely the game changer when it came to an unknown artist, so to speak, getting their work out to a massive audience.
And your YouTube channel, which is Brave Wilderness, for people who are not familiar with it, I mean, I'm sure many people will be, considering you've got over 20 million subscribers. Is it 20 million or even more now?
Yeah, that's a little bit more. It's like 20 and a half million or somewhere around there. Wow. At this point.
Well, I mean, it's unbelievable. So when you started that channel, this was in 2014, right?
Yep, correct. Yep.
And at that time, was being a YouTuber, you know, sort of viewed like it is now? Now it's kind of like, I'm a YouTuber, like I'm a rock star.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, was it considered like that, or was it much rarer to find people making their full-time living off YouTube?
Yeah. Well, you know, YouTube's gone through a handful of different shifts over the years, from its original creation to then content being monetized to then them reworking algorithm systems to limit your reach based on a couple of negative things that happened within the platform. So when we really sort of hit our peak in 2016, so the channel launched in September of 2014. By September of 2016, we were on the rocket ship ride, essentially. We went from like 500,000 subscribers to 5 million subscribers in like a 6-month period. We then went from 5 million subscribers to 10 million subscribers in less than 2 years, which at the time we were one of the fastest growing channels in YouTube's history, which is pretty crazy considering it was all centering around animals. But when you go back to the question of like, is being a YouTuber like being a rock star? I think to a younger generation, you would probably hear people saying that, but I'm always very careful to compartmentalize like what it is to be a YouTuber versus what it is to be a celebrity versus what it is to be an artist, because I think there's a lot of content on YouTube that a lot of artists would be like, it's just somebody running around with a shaky camera. There's no real thought process to any of what that is. But at the same time, if that's the art that somebody's choosing to make, it would be like comparing, you know, harmonica music to heavy metal. You know, there are two different ways to look at the art. So from our perspective and from my background, I've always looked at it as the storytelling side of things. And we've always approached things from a cinematographic perspective when it comes to how we shoot our episodes, how they're cut together post-production, what is the voiceover script that goes with it, what is the music that ties it all together. So we very much look at ourselves as artists creating our work and then distributing it in a YouTube space. So when people are like, oh, you're a YouTuber, I'm like, well, yeah, I distribute on YouTube, but it is literally just one of the many places our content is distributed. And when you pull back the curtain on what all of Brave Wilderness is as a brand, and like, you know, if I meet somebody randomly at a coffee shop and they're like, oh man, tell me more about Brave Wilderness, and I go into the details of like how in depth our brand is at this point, they're like, whoa, you guys are way more than just people out there making YouTube videos. But the great thing about YouTube, what it's always been and hopefully what it will always continue to be, is this platform that gives anybody who has ambition and talent the chance to share their work, their art with the world. And we just happen to be in the right place at the right time to say, hey, this is how we're going to go about it. My business partner, Mark, and I own all the intellectual property rights to everything that surrounds our multiple companies and the entire brand. And that's a big thing that you are oftentimes not allotted when it comes to the television or movie distribution world. Somebody's going to own what it is that you've got. You might get the chance to make it and you're getting a paycheck, but if you don't own it, it doesn't have as much value. So that's where we're probably a little bit different than most creators outside of the YouTube realm, I would say.
That makes sense. Yeah, well, I mean, the whole benefit of YouTube is as distribution. And as you're pointing out, which is so true, and where the misconception for some people with being on YouTube or being a YouTuber, quote unquote, may lie, you know, there's a big difference between having, you know, multiple different companies, licensing deals with other distribution platforms, and like this whole infrastructure and this whole idea. I mean, obviously, first and foremost, you're a storyteller and a wildlife educator, and YouTube is the platform that you chose. But was there any difference? Did you have to make any form of compromise to thrive on that platform where it's, you know, it's not quite social media like Instagram, but their algorithms, as you alluded to, have you had to change up the type of content that you are making to succeed on this platform, or have you just solely been focused on your excellent storytelling and on, you know, just being an authentic brand and just being your best?
That's a great question. So, you know, very timely too, because one of the biggest challenges that we are now facing as a brand, and the way that, you know, the internet is constantly evolving, right? Like if I had a time travel machine and could go back to 2016, 17, and 18 and be like, oh my gosh, could we just keep the YouTube algorithm the way that it is right now? It would be a whole different game. But things like Facebook beginning to distribute video lends in a challenge. Things like TikTok coming to the table lends in a challenge, because now there are more content creators and more platforms for them to share their content on. The pool as a whole has gotten very diluted. So to keep the attention and the eyeballs on YouTube the way that we used to is much more difficult. YouTube is now also making a big shift this next year into creating short form content. So it's called YouTube Shorts, if you haven't heard about it, but it's essentially YouTube's answer to the TikTok phenomenon and YouTube's fight to try to keep more of the eyeballs on their platform than it is everybody that's now doing this on TikTok and Instagram stories. So, you know, where the majority of viewing took place on the internet 3-4 years ago, being YouTube space, that's no longer the case. So we're now being faced with the challenge of how do you tell a very engaging story in 60 seconds? Because we're going to be doing YouTube Shorts in 2023, when supposedly it's going to become monetized, we are then going to need to adapt to survive in that world. Now, myself as an artist and a creator, I'm interested in telling the longer form story. You know, we always felt we were really clever because we would take the kind of content you would see in an hour-long television special and whittle it down into a fast-paced 10 to 15 minute runtime, which for most people is like, holy cow, I learned all this about all these animals or this animal and its environment, et cetera, in 12 minutes. Great. I can watch 4 or 5 of these in the same amount of time that I watch an entire hour-long TV show. Well, now it's like people don't have 10 minutes worth of time unless you're doing something really extreme and it's going really, really, really fast. So we're having to learn how to either turn episodes into multiple acts, which we've always done, but more definitive acts where you're like, you're getting this, you're getting this, you're getting this. It's what Mr. Beast does, if you're familiar with his content. In all of his episodes, it's like challenge, 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 money, 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 money. You know, people having to keep that attention span for that amount of time. We're now trying to figure out how do we do that in the animal world, in the adventure world, still keep it educational, still keep it entertaining, and still make sure it has enough context so that people understand what it is that we're doing with these animals or how we're engaging with them. Does that make sense?
Wow, yeah, that's a real, I mean, obviously you've built yourself an empire, mm-hmm. And you've got a challenge of growing because obviously you're ambitious, but it also sounds like a difficult situation just from YouTube trying to compete with TikTok. Is that going to have a damaging effect in your view on society and on humanity? Because if we've got to start creating content that's only 60 seconds long, what's become of us?
I know. I'll be honest with you. I already have a problem with it. And that's where like we're in a bit of a rock and a hard place right now as a brand, because we've always felt very good about the style of content we were producing, the type of education and entertainment that we're trying to get out there to the world. Always a conservation message or a preservation message where applicable. And now it's like we're having to evolve to keep up with a system that's forcing people to have less of an attention span for things. And it's this weird crux of being like, well, do you want to survive and evolve with it and be a part of that? Or you just want to stay stuck like a dinosaur in your old ways and be like, you know what? We're only making 15 minute videos. You guys don't want to watch them, don't watch them, but we're going to keep doing that because that's how we want to educate and entertain people. And while those videos are always going to have a value, I think for us, it's going to be finding the balance to walk between providing short form content, but also still holding to our morals of providing that longer form content, but putting a little bit more time and value into the production quality, which may be a good balance for us because keeping up with the YouTube ecosystem, which I'm sure you'll hear a lot of other, you know, YouTubers admit to this, it's a burn, man. Like we've been doing this now for over 8 years. And when you think about releasing videos at least once a week. There was a time when we were releasing 2 or 3 videos a week. I think we've got somewhere close to like 720 or 30 videos at this point. And we're not filming them in a studio. You know, 99% of everything that we do is out in the wild somewhere. So to keep up with that cadence is very, very difficult, very daunting and tiring, but we love it. I mean, I could never have a better job than what I have now, but you look at that balance over time to say, okay, does something like this eventually just come to an end? Are people not going to be interested in animals anymore? Are they only interested in their 60 seconds that flies by them on their screen of, you know, somebody showing you how you can cut a tomato in half 40 different ways? You know, like that's what TikTok and Shorts is full of. So it's definitely going to be a challenge for us to figure out how to evolve into that system while still providing people with education and entertainment.
Yeah, well, it seems like it's something that you're grappling with, but equally, You hear lots of people saying that actually it's a misconception that the human race is heading in the direction of only short form content and TikTok reels, because I mean, just look at Joe Rogan. He's got like 2 hour, 3 hour podcasts and he's got a huge audience. What do you say to people who tell you that and who tell you that there's like actually a huge market for long form?
I think we are going to reach a point of fast food content consumption burnout, right? Like it's going to get to the point where like something's going to happen and that system is going to break down and people are going to be like, just give me something of more substance to watch. The same way that, you know, binge watching shows on Netflix was such a fad for a few years, and then Disney Plus and some of these other networks migrated it back to one a week. It's like, do you need to watch the whole thing at once? Because the production teams and the post-production teams and the distributors themselves can't keep up with that supply and demand, especially from like the rungs down below, what you would call below the line, right? All the people that are physically making it that are not the directors, producers, and actors, and even them included, you can only produce so much content within a given year. So I do think that, you know, somebody like Joe Rogan, who has built a phenomenal career for himself over multiple decades, he's got the fan following that will be able to sustain this fast burnout type of consumption. Brave Wilderness, I would not say is by any means on the Joe Rogan caliber. And because of the streams that we distribute through, we do need to find a way to evolve, but we are always going to be producing some of that longer form content because I believe that the true fans, the people that really do want all of that information and education, are always going to resort back to absorbing it.
That's interesting. And so your career involves far more than algorithms and platforms and content. What's actually at its heart is not only humanity, but wildlife and nature, and actually in a way getting as far from these devices that almost sometimes feel you know, anti-science and anti-nature. So you've been all over the world. Has your love or of traveling been affected in any way by having to combine it with your career?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I would say my love of travel has only intensified by combining my career into it. And it's funny, a lot of times people be like, oh, you know, Coyote, when do you ever take vacations or what do you do on vacation? I'm like, vacation for me is usually being at home and doing yard work and, you know, just hanging out. Because I travel so much of the year into so many amazing places and my job's phenomenal. I mean, I get to travel to these remote places and see these amazing animals. And I'm not a real big, like, let me go to a huge city and experience a lot of that. I like being lost out in nature for my job. And, you know, this time of year, I do a little bit more traveling for like media and appearances and stuff like that. So that kind of sucks you into that more city dynamic sort of experience. But when it comes to traveling to different places around the globe and experiencing those environments, having those animal encounters and being able to capture it all on camera with honestly some of my best friends who I travel with, I really wouldn't have it any other way than how it is now. And when it comes to, you know, the next steps and stuff like that for us, we're just always looking for the next great story to be able to tell. Because you're right, for us, it really does have to do at the core of it all is telling the story for the animal. Like an animal's not going to pick up a camera, an animal's not going to write a voiceover script, an animal's not going to put the puzzle pieces together in post-production and allow the world to understand why you don't need to be afraid of you don't need to be afraid of these things. These are creatures that we need to be protecting. Their environments need to be preserved. And if somebody doesn't speak on behalf of them and dispel a lot of the myths and falsehoods, then animals are going to continue, you know, going the way of the dinosaurs. So we feel we have that responsibility to open up certainly all generations, but most specifically the next generation's eyes to why animals and the preservation of our planet are so important.
Yeah, well, it now seems like a more pressing time than ever, but I feel like people are saying that every year that goes by. In terms of the sheer amount of animals that you've been exposed to, and the unusual situations that you've constantly found yourself in, has there been a fair amount of learning on the job for you?
Oh yeah. Every time that we film an episode, we learn something new. Nothing is like clockwork. We have a handful of episodes that we'll produce. I mean, the Bite and Sting episodes, which obviously are some of the most famous, those have a formulaic nature to them in that they're a little bit more controlled, where we may be on an adventure to find or catch something, and then we bring it into a setting where it's like, okay, this is where the bite or sting is going to take place. Like, what you can't see right now is actually on the other side of my computer here is our base camp studio. So this looks like this here, something totally different over there. Tomorrow morning, we have 300,000 maggots showing up. There's an entire set built here on the other side of this camera, where I'm going to be placing one naked foot and one foot inside of a meat sock. A meat sock is, yes, raw meat sewn together to look like a sock, and both feet are going in there for several hours to see, will maggots eat human flesh?
Oh, my life above.
300,000 of them. My feet are going to be in there for several hours to see what happens. And either A, will they eat the living human flesh of my foot? Or B, will they eat through the meat sock and not know where to stop if my foot is sort of coagulated into that mass of meat? So we don't know what's going to happen. But to my point, it's a bit more of a studio shoot versus being out in the wild. So it's something that we've done before with other animals in a controlled setting like this. So in that sense, we do kind of know what we're doing, but we're going to learn something new just because of the nature of everything that's built around it. And every episode that we end up producing, whether in a studio or in nature, we are always learning as to what can we do better next time.
I mean, that really sounds incredibly daunting, but I guess, I mean, do you have, because you've done things that many, more ordinary people would not even consider doing in a million mm-hmm. years. And presumably, you know, you seem like you've not been struggling to sleep and that, you know, this is, it's not another day at the office, because I think you recognize how insane that sounds to us mere mortals. But in terms of like these big things that you're filming, these stunts, is there a genuine part of your mind with some of this stuff that like it's going to go wrong?
There's always a chance, but it is a very slim chance, and I don't want to like pull back the veil on too much of the mystery, so to speak. I mean, you could be stung by a single yellow jacket and go into anaphylactic shock and die. And I only mention yellow jackets because literally this morning we just got finished in post-production on an episode that comes out on Black Friday this year, which here in the United States is like the big advertising day of the year. I put my hand into a box with 100 angry yellow jackets and got stung like almost 100 times in 10 seconds. It was the dumbest thing I've ever done. My hand got stuck in the box. I took more stings than I thought I was going to. My hand like doubled in size with the swelling, and it was the most intense pain I've ever had to endure for 24 straight hours. And actually my arm is still messed up. I'm having some sort of nerve issue now going on with my arm from the damage of those stings. But for the most part, we know that a lot of these bites and stings are not going to run the risk of being catastrophic. It's not like I'm sticking my arm into the mouth of a great white shark or a saltwater crocodile. So we do a lot of research in advance, but that's not to say that, well, is the next one going to be the unlucky one where you do go into anaphylactic shock? Has my body built up a sensitivity to venoms? At this point, we're always questioning that, but it hasn't happened yet. And we always have an epinephrine pen on site. So if worst case scenario, I was like, oh, my throat's swelling up, I'm going into anaphylactic shock, we literally hit me with that epinephrine pen, I'd be good. We'd get me to the hospital, I'd be fine. It's not like I'm intentionally getting bitten by venomous snakes or blue ring octopus or box jellyfish. So, you know, we walk a fine line between crazy and brilliant. And somewhere right in the middle there is what makes the Brave Wilderness brand work.
And when did you, was it from the beginning that you were kind of conducting these pretty dangerous sounding experiments? Was it from the word go, or did it kind of happen unintentionally?
It happened completely unintentionally, because I can tell you one thing. I say this to people all the time. when it comes to being a wildlife presenter, and if you were to ever talk to any other of the greats that have done this in the past, anybody that works with animals would tell you, you don't work with animals if you're not good at not being bitten and stung. Like, that's the idea, is to not get bitten by things. We just so happened to stumble upon the fact that people found that really, really engaging. And it started with a couple of bites, then led into the stings. And I was very heavily influenced, and still am, always have been, by George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. I mean, I grew up on their films for the most part, from Star Wars, Jaws, Indiana Jones franchise, Jurassic Park, I mean, you name it. So my entire life, I have been studying what George Lucas and Steven Spielberg have done to build their brands. And one of the things that any good movie director is fantastic at is taking a script and turning it into entertainment on screen. So with the insect sting pain index, the whole thing that I climbed up that became wildly popular was based off of a book by entomologist Justin Schmidt, who created this insect sting pain index. And I had seen the book and I looked at it. And once we realized that this kind of bite stuff was popular, we were like, well, how do we Steven Spielberg this thing? How do we take the book and turn it into the movie form, right? Make the video that is super entertaining and show people, well, what would happen if you got stung by a tarantula, hawk, or a bullet ant? Like, what does the body go through? And it was that approach to things that we realized very quickly, based on the virality of it on the internet, was an interesting thing to approach. And at the end of the day, if you look at all the videos we have, only about maybe 2% of them are the extreme content where I'm ever bitten or stung by something. And it was those videos that helped to draw in a massive audience to the other content. And whether that was getting up close with an ocelot, or palling around with a wolverine, or filming, you know, rhinos in South Africa, it was the entry point to Brave Wilderness that became all the insect stings for the most part.
And has your relationship with animals changed the way that you think of animals? And, you know, how have you evolved over this process over this last near decade?
I have only garnered more of an appreciation for the level of intelligence that animals are capable of displaying. Intelligence and ability to communicate, strangely enough. And not all animals, but it's amazing when you get hands-on with, or you're in the environment with some of these things, or you're face-to-face with some of these things, and you can really see how smart and connected they are. And while they may not be speaking the same language that you and I recognize, they're very much in tune with their surrounding. Even some of the weird insects that I've seen out there, I mean, they're curious, they're charismatic, and I've garnered an even greater love for the natural world by allowing myself to be as submersed in it as I have been. And honestly, in some instances, taking the pain that it has to offer me, I guess, as strange as that might sound, I garner more of an appreciation for why these animals do what it is that they do. And those things may make some people afraid, but when you really realize how tough the human body is, it's like, ooh, nobody wants pain. But if we can help people understand that in a worst case scenario, you're going to go through something uncomfortable, you're going to be just fine, that a lot of times helps people sleep at night.
In terms of your relationship with pain, you know, have you always been someone who's been able to withstand seemingly gargantuan amounts of pain?
Yeah, I think I really have. I did not cry much as a kid, right? Falling off of bikes, getting scraped knees, getting in fist fights and getting, you know, walloped in the face here. Like, you know what I mean? I never really cried as a kid. So I kind of knew I had a tolerance to take pain. And, you know, there's been a number of times where we've been called out with some of our bite and sting episodes to be like, man, you got to be so dramatic. I'm like, well, I don't need to be that dramatic. But think about this. Have you ever hit your thumb with a hammer, or have you ever stubbed your toe on the corner of a table in the middle of the night and you jump around and you scream and you swear? We were like, well, we don't want Coyote Peterson to ever be swearing, because we want our content to be friendly for families and for kids. So how do you express pain without swear words and while still keeping it contained in front of a camera? So my approach to it, with the roll around on the ground, the punch your hands into the dirt, the loud, weird noises, we had no idea that that was going to become such an entertaining thing for the audience, but it's my expressive way of being like, this really hurts. And I can either sit there and just be like, yep, it really hurts. Or you can put on more of a presentation with it. That is where the entertainment factor comes in. And, you know, lo and behold, you've got videos with tens of millions of views that continue to crank the views and educate people about these animals. And at the end of the day, that's what it was all about. How do you get these unsung heroes of the animal world on screen and getting people to pay attention for enough time with a lot of entertainment and the right sliver of education so that when they walk away, they're like, huh, that was crazy and entertaining. And now I know this about the tarantula hawk or the bullet ant or the Japanese giant hornet. So, you know, we had a very, what we feel, clever approach to how we formulaically have created some of those more extreme episodes. And then, of course, we're telling more of the natural history adventure ones. The adventure just kind of takes you by the hand and tells the story itself.
How do you approach writing versus, you know, making video content? And how much of your year is spent writing versus making video?
Well, a few years back, the writing was much more a part of it. Now it's harder to put voiceover into episodes because, you know, attention deficit disorder, people don't have the palate for like, cool, here's a voiceover scene with animations and very beautiful drone shots. You know, if they're not watching on Netflix or Hulu or Planet Earth, they're like, eh, cool, get me on to the next thing. So we've been trying to get more of the story points out all in the field without there being any voiceover, but nothing that we do is scripted. That's one thing that people used to ask way back then, like, well, what does a script look like for a Brave Wilderness episode? And I'd say, well, there isn't a script. Everything that you see happens completely naturally. The only script that evolves is when we come back from production and we're putting it together in post-production, and I would write in a voiceover that helps you tie together this, this, and this, to keep it all super succinct. And now we're trying to do just more of that in the field to keep it more free flowing. But me personally, for the type of content that I enjoy, you know, documentaries on Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime, et cetera, I like the good narrative setup. For me as a writer, that's what I enjoy doing. Finding the right mathematical equation with words that can build up to you understanding the sum of it all, or your, so to speak, answer at the end. People always have questions. How do you get them those answers as clearly and concisely as possible?
It's interesting about the scripting because, yeah, I guess a lot of people must have had that misconception. I mean, you've achieved so much, obviously, with Brave Wilderness that you could easily be resting on your laurels and just kind of operating on autopilot almost, or just enjoying the ride, you know. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you're very keenly attuned to, you know, how YouTube's evolving and what the content market is like. And you actually alluded to something there briefly of you know, people aren't going to be watching this on Netflix. Is one of the reasons why Netflix has been going slightly downhill, at least in terms of their stock price, is that just because people can't be bothered to watch TV anymore? It's actually got to the point where watching TV is too much effort for people.
I am afraid of that personally. You know, like I wonder the same thing. Like right now, Netflix and Facebook's stocks are like dropping, right? I granted all of our society right now is kind of doing this economically to a certain extent. And whether you want to accept that we're in a recession or not, you know, everybody's got their own opinions with that. But when it comes to the Netflixes and the Facebooks, and people are so connected to their mobile devices. They spend so much time just flipping from this thing to the next thing to the next thing. I don't know if people are getting tired of watching long form content. I am not one of those people. I want to watch long form content. Now, I will admit, I've become exhausted with long running television series, right? After committing to things like some of the shows I've watched in the past, Lost, Sons of Anarchy, Boardwalk Empire, Sopranos, Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones. It's like, do I have 8 or 9 years to commit to a television series at this point? Not really. I haven't watched any of the new Lord of the Rings stuff. Haven't watched the new Game of Thrones House of the Dragon. I'm like, I need to step back from like consuming that much long form content. I love, you know, 90-minute documentaries or 3 to 8-part miniseries where like you're giving me the beginning, and I know that there's an end in sight. I don't like there not being an end in sight with, you know, some of these series that are out there. It's not to say that the series aren't phenomenal, but like, I'm one of the people that gave up on The Walking Dead like five seasons in because I was like, there's just no end in sight here. Where are we going? How much more time can I commit to like this brutality of human existence through the screen? It's kind of made me feel gross inside. So I'm very much in the support of documentaries, length projects, or something that's going to be a mini series. And I think that's probably where we're going to land ultimately, where people are going to get burnt out on the long form series. They're going to realize that the super short TikTok flow of things is just not helpful. And we're going to be somewhere right in the middle. And I'm pretty sure it's all going to come back to making 12 to 15 minute videos or something of the likes, which is what we specialize in. So my fingers are crossed for that in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I think you might be right. I'm not so sure about this YouTube Shorts thing, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. It seems, I mean, I've never used TikTok in my life. I mean, I might have been on it, but like as a, just the idea does not appeal. I'm not interested. But I know that I'm in the minority, and it's all the rage right now. But nonetheless, it's too short to get any value out of anything. And by the time the video is finished, I'm thinking my concentration has slipped. You know, I want to engage in something for longer than that. But I think people have a huge wealth of content that you've created to get to grips with. Is there anything before we wrap this up that you want people to focus on in terms of stuff that you've got coming out this year? And it would be good to know from my perspective as well.
Yeah, well, we've got so much stuff in the works, and that's the thing that, you know, a lot of people don't realize behind the veil of the frontward facing side of the Brave Wilderness brand. We've got a massive cartoon that's in development right now. So it's our first foray into the animated world, which will certainly be for a younger age demographic. It's like the 9 to 12-year-old world that we're trying to hit specifically with that. You know, I certainly look at the fact that I'm 41 years old. Like, I don't know how long I'm going to be, you know, a physical superhuman running around in the environments, climbing trees, and getting stung by stuff. So we're always looking for, all right, is an animated direction followed by video games a good direction to go? I'm hugely involved with a project called Museum Traveler right now, which is the VR and augmented reality side of where parks and museums are headed. And I'm sort of the face of what that project is in development. But for the stuff that people can see quickly and immediately, we always save our best content for the last two quarters of the year. So between late October, pretty much now, and November and December, we've got just some absolute banger episodes coming out, including me sticking my hand into a box with 100 yellow jackets. We're getting ready to produce the Maggot Box episode tomorrow. We're doing a Punched by a Mantis Shrimp episode in a couple of weeks. And we've got probably one of our biggest conservation episodes of the year coming out in 2 weeks. That's all about jaguars in the Brazilian Pantanal. It took us 3 weeks to film the episode. It's the closest we've come to planet Earth type cinematography. The narrative, it's one of our most proud pieces of content we've ever created on the Brave Wilderness channel. So yeah, next 8 weeks or so are going to be pretty exciting from our camp.
Wow, they sound like incredible episodes. And we've already heard a bit about a couple of them, the maggots, for one. I wish you all the best with that, all the best of luck. Coyote, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast. Really, really appreciate your time.
Oh yeah, my pleasure, Tom. And I did check out your YouTube channel, man. Man, you got it down with the Elton John covers, dude. Keep at that, man. Your transformation from you into the Elton stuff, I was like, wow, that is amazing. So keep at it, man. I'm a fan. I'll be watching.